I'm Chris Nolte. Let's find out more about stories in the Times of Northwest Indiana, in particular about transportation issues here in the region. And we'll find out more from Andrew Steele, who covers transportation for the Times. Andrew, thanks for being with us on the show today.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Your story recently talks about the latest concerning the South Shore expansion projects and one leg of the expansion in particular. Tell us about that, what the NICTI board had to talk about the other day.
So they did have some action on the double track project, and that's a project, of course, to add a second set of tracks between Gary and Michigan City, about 17 miles of tracks, four new bridges, new platforms and stations along the way, and so other associated infrastructure. Anyway, they're at a point right now that they are getting down to the end of what they need to do to get a grant agreement with the Federal Transit Administration to pay almost 40% of the project, the FTA grant would do. And there obviously a lot of engineering needs to be done in advance of that. And so recently they've had some more engineering that caused them to need to put in place another small funding source for the project, which the price now is right around $450 million. So, you know, the mid $400 million for the project right now, which is a little bit higher based on some added costs recently. So basically the board on Monday told the administration that they could, if necessary, sell some bonds. This would be, at least a year or more down the road, if it's necessary at all. But the FTA, basically before they'll make a grant agreement with you, requires every dollar of funding locally to be in place, not just to be accounted for, but for each government agency that needs to have approved it. So you've got all the legal approvals in place. So that's what the board did on Monday.
I know that in particular, this the double tracking project is maybe not quite as involved as what the Westlake Corridor segment of the project is about, but it's still pretty involved. It's not just laying an extra set of tracks down between Gary Metro and Michigan City and putting the new tracks in, I guess, all the way through downtown Michigan City. It's more involved than that, isn't it?
Yeah, there are four bridges. The new platforms and stations will bring more of them to high-level status. High-level platform is one where you walk just levelly from the platform to the train, no steps or anything. In Michigan City, there'll be a new 11th Street station, but 11th Street itself will be converted to a one-way eastbound traffic alongside the station. They're closing 21 at-grade roadway rail crossings in Michigan City. So a lot of the smaller streets that cut right across that track now will be closed off. The track itself will be moved from the middle of the road to the side of the road. So huge changes in Michigan City in particular.
I get the impression, and maybe you did, in fact, you mentioned that in the story, too, about the fact that we're getting close to finding out something from the FTA concerning funding for the second part of the big project, in this case, the Westlake Corridor extension. And I guess they've also been working up some way to find some additional funds, a grant request this is going to be going through, I understand?
Yeah, and so it's a similar situation that the FTA grant would fund around 38% or so of that project, and Westlake is the extension from Hammond down to Dyer, about 8 miles new track there, and yeah, they could be, within coming weeks, within the next month or so, get that what's called a full funding grant agreement. Now, that puts them in place to actually begin actual construction. Obviously, a lot of engineering work has been done, but that's the final thing to get that project going. So it could be going in earnest this year.
We're talking with Andrew Steele, who covers transportation issues for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Andrew, since you've had a chance to follow this whole project pretty much from the start, and certainly within the last months or so, what's been your observation as to how things are coming along on this particular project, even though we're still in the midst of the coronavirus pandemic?
Yeah, I mean, things really have been going as planned, going apace with the project. So, I mean, early this year on the Westlake project, before the pandemic set in, NICTI had opened proposals for the companies that would actually do the construction work, final design and construction work. Then this summer, they awarded a contract to a team. The companies are FH Passion and Ragnar Benson, two separate companies that work in this area that have been awarded the contract. They've actually signed the contract to go ahead and do this. NICTI is going to sign it as soon as they get that full funding grant agreement from the FTA, and then they will issue what's called a notice to proceed, and then it will be underway.
That's going to be underway. It's a very important part of the project, certainly, the funding, because I know there was, as you recall, and you've known from even going back in the archives and looking at past stories, that there was a lot of talk, a lot of ink was put out on the work up to that point as well, and particularly as people were talking and complaining about, I guess, in the public meetings, about what this project was going to do to their neighborhoods and everything, too, I understand.
Yeah, you know, and honestly, I think that most people, really for the last year or so at least, you know, have accepted that these are going to happen. You know, I mean, the railroad itself is well into property acquisition process for these. According to them, it's all been going well. I mean, sometimes it ends up in court to get things settled finally, but for the most part, it's being settled between the railroad and the property owners. So that's going along. You know, there's a lot of planning going on with the communities and with the involvement of the Regional Development Authority in terms of what things are going to look like along the route, and especially at the train stations.
Well, Andrew, thank you for spending time and giving us the latest from the folks with the South Shore Line and NICTI about the projects as they are coming together and the funding matters that have to come in place here or get at least set up if they need the help. And we appreciate the stories today. We'll have you back on again soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Andrew Steele covers transportation for the Times of Northwest Indiana. This is Regionally Speaking. The new orientation video for the Indiana Dunes National Park is making its debut at the 49er Drive-In. Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson spoke recently with Dustin Ritchie, who's the production director for Indiana Dunes Tourism, about the movie night event, which is also a fundraiser that will be held at the 49er Drive-In on October 8th.
So thanks a lot for taking the time to talk to me right now. Can you tell me about the new National Park film at the 49er Drive-In that's going to be shown?
Yeah, so we're really excited to be in partnership with the National Park Service, as well as Smith Donovan, who is the director of the production. And what this is going to be is it's going to be a kind of a fundraising gala event to showcase the new orientation video for the Indiana Dunes National Park. It's a never-before-seen video, and we're really excited to be able to share it with locals, visitors, residents. And the 49er Drive-In actually donated the venue for us to be able to do this as kind of a community outreach.
So the film, can you describe what the film is?
Yeah, so currently in our visitor center, the Indiana Dunes Visitor Center on Highway 49, located at 1215 North State Road 49, the National Park Service has a kind of an orientation film so that when guests are coming to the area, they can learn a little bit about the Indiana Dunes. Well, we work with Smith Donovan to produce a brand new orientation film. This film is going to tell you about the history of the dunes, about the ecology, and not to brag, but honestly, it has at the very least a PBS documentary style, if not National Geographic, and really shows the beauty and diversity of our area.
I was going to say, how's the photography and the filming?
Oh, it truly is incredible. We got to show it to the National Park Service because we were working as the project manager with Smith Donovan, and when we finally got to show it to them, they were thrilled. And that's kind of the reason we want to produce such a large event, is because the video that we're going to be showing really is awe-inspiring.
Now, I understand that this event is also a fundraiser. Can you tell me what the money is going to be used for?
Sure. So the money, any of the proceeds from this event are going to go toward the Indiana Dunes Visitor Enhancement Project. So we've had some redesign plans in the works for quite a while now, and so we're going to try to use that money to help with some of the redesign aspects. The visitor center is actually about 14 years old, and while that doesn't sound like a lot, there are some things that we have learned, and now that we're a national park, there are some things that we could definitely update to improve a visitor's experience. And one of the things that we've noticed, a lot of residents and visitors don't always realize that visitor center is actually hosting the National Park Service. So the rangers are actually there. It's not just the tourism entity. So we have some redesign project that we've been wanting to work on, and so any of the proceeds is going to go to try to help fund that. It's going to be going toward things that are like for visitor experience. So we're looking to update the entrance to the visitor center. We're trying to get a more interactive exhibit, things that you would find in a normal national park visitor center, like maps and different things like that. We're trying to increase the visitor's experience.
The visitor center doesn't have that kind of stuff now, or?
It has it, but not in the way that it has an interactive area. We have a video conference. We have like a video center. The redesign project is trying to add more of that. So I guess the best example I could say is one of the things that they were going to try to do is they were going to try to build like a little exhibit that showed the way that dunes form, you know, so that children could go up and actually play with this and see the way the dunes form. All of these are just plans. Nothing is set in stone. But that's kind of the way that we're looking at it. We're trying to figure out ways to have more interactive exhibits for visitors.
And so, in summary, the event, can you tell us, it's on October 8th?
Correct.
And it's at 5:30 p.m.?
Yeah, so the house will open at 5:30, and the movie will start at 6:30.
And how do people get tickets?
Tickets are available on eventbrite.com. So the name of the event is, let me give you the exact name. The name of the event is New Indiana Dunes Nature's Masterpiece Film Premiere. And they're available right now on Eventbrite. One thing that we would like to let people know, though, if they are interested in buying, is that we're assuming that every order, not every ticket, but every order is a car full. So, for example, if you order four tickets in one order, the assumption is that you're coming in one car. And the reason for that is that this event, we only have 225 parking spots available. So we just have to make sure that people know that.
So you want everybody, you buy a ticket, you bring one car only, but you can have five people in the car?
Yeah, and everybody that comes will need a ticket, though. So the order itself represents the car. So the way that it works online is if you're buying a ticket, you can buy, I believe, up to 10 tickets. The assumption is that you're coming in like a van, unless you note it. And we have a place for people to note that they're coming in multiple vehicles.
Well, is there anything else that maybe I haven't asked you about that you want to mention that before we wrap it up?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, one of the things is that this video is actually going to, the tickets are $35 per person. And again, that is going to help with the fundraiser. But what that ticket buys you is it buys you your entrance to see the premiere, the world premiere of this viewing. It's also going to get you a snack box lunch provided by Ivy's Bohemia House. There will be live music presented by Johnny V, and there will be a cash bar available as well. And it will also come with a double feature, just kind of like the normal 49er drive-in experience. And the double feature is going to be a showing of the 45-minute documentary National Park Adventures, and that is narrated by Robert Redford.
Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me about this.
Oh, we're really, really excited about it. I mean, well, one of the things that we're being very cautious about is the fact that we want this to be a COVID-safe event. And so the one thing that's really nice is while we will have live entertainment, we will have a cash bar. For people who don't even want to leave their car, they don't have to. So they can stay in their car. We will be handing them the box snack, and they can watch the films from the safety of their car.
What's in the box snack?
It's still being determined, but it's going to be, I actually have it. Give me a sec. There were between two options, but it'll be like fruits, and it'll be different cheeses, assortments, cookies, meat sticks, things like that.
Because the concession stand's going to be closed, and that's due to COVID, right?
Well, the concession stand, actually, they've been having the concession stand open, but because this event was donated by the 49er, they are giving us permission to use the lot, but they don't have staff to run the concession stand. So that's why we're providing catering.
I see. Well, thanks so much, Dustin. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
That's Dustin Ritchie. He is the production director for Indiana Dunes Tourism, speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson. This is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte, and it's time to check on another reporter's series of stories from the Times. We have a business reporter, Joe Pete, with us. Joe, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, had a major story and a couple other interesting stories that we want to bring up. And let's talk about the big news, probably the one that's going to shake up more people than anybody else. If it hasn't already, it certainly will. And we're talking about the shift of ownership that is impending with ArcelorMittal USA. Tell us about that story and some more details.
Yes, there is a major, major seismic shakeup on the industrial lakeshore of Northwest Indiana. Many of the steel mill, ArcelorMittal USA, of course, has been a major presence in the region since it was formed in around 2006 during the last big wave of consolidation in the U.S. steel industry. And during that time, it ended U.S. steel. Most of the mills, you know, that had been owned by separate companies that had been around for like a century, you know, LTV, Inland, you know, and so forth. And a lot of them ended up going into bankruptcy. And they all ended up kind of either a U.S. steel mill or a ArcelorMittal mill. And now ArcelorMittal is pretty much exiting the U.S. market entirely. It will still have a it'll still run the ArcelorMittal Global R&D facility in East Chicago, Klein in Columbus. That's going to continue to do researchers on or continue to do research there on its steel products. However, it is completely offloading its U.S. operations and basically what looks like a fire sale. The company has been investing in, they're trying to cut their carbon emissions globally because of, you know, climate change and regulations and so forth. And they're also been investing in higher growth areas like India. And they just launched a mill or did a big investment in South Africa and some of the less developed markets. But basically, right now, they have sold off their U.S. operations to Cleveland Cliffs for $1.4 billion. However, a lot of people, that kind of price is a little bit eye-popping because a lot of people assumed that their footprint, which stretches across, you know, most or a significant chunk of the United States, would be worth a lot more. Reuters has estimated that, you know, the worth of ArcelorMittal USA to be like at least two to three billion. So it kind of looks like a fire sale price.
Yeah.
But they have sold multiple mills, including ArcelorMittal East Chicago or Indiana Harbor in East Chicago, ArcelorMittal Burns Harbor in Porter County, ArcelorMittal Riverdale in South Suburbs, the Gary Plate Finishing Facility that they operate inside. The Gary Works steel mill and their 60% interest in IN Tech JV and their 50% interest in IN Tech Coat JV in New Carlisle, which they own with Nippon Steel, and which gets all, you know, the steel shipped in by train daily from Indiana Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is going to change hands now to Cleveland Cliffs. Cleveland Cliffs is a company that's been around for 173 years, but they've mostly been doing iron ore mining and pelletization. They only actually got into the steel. They've been working on a direct reduced iron project in Toledo for a couple years, but they only recently got into steel making when they purchased AK Steel in earlier this year. And now this kind of effectively makes them suddenly overnight like the largest flat rolled steelmaker in North America with shipments of 17 million tons last year. And they're also the largest iron ore pellet producer with 28 million tons of capacity. And they're saying, you know, the Cleveland Cliffs and ArcelorMittal are saying consolidation makes sense. They're it's going to result, obviously, in more like vertical integration of the steelmaking process. Iron ore is, you know, probably the biggest, you know, natural resource going into steel. And then, you know, ArcelorMittal did have a couple mines, but, you know, they're, you know, now the steelmaking operations, they won't have to pay for the same market prices and spot prices for iron ore, which oftentimes will wipe out gains. You know, steel price, part of the problem with the steel industry in recent years is, you know, the tariffs help, you know, drive up the demand for steel, but then a lot of the gains in prices would be like substantially wiped out or reduced by, you know, all of a sudden they'd have much higher import costs because the iron ore prices would then soar or scrap prices would soar for the mini mills. And it would be, you know, that was one of the issues that was kind of dogging their profitability. But this is a huge change. And unfortunately, when you have mergers like this, it unfortunately often will reduce in layoffs. There are, you know, positions will be deemed redundant, you know, especially kind of corporate positions often. We don't know yet. We've got a lot of unanswered questions we can get to in our reporting. We don't know what's going to happen with pensions yet. We don't know what's going to happen. If there some analysts have suggested that new companies should come in, close some of the facilities and kind of reduce, because there's issues of overcapacity in the U.S. steel industry as a lot of new mini mills come online. It's not yet known what they're going to do, what they're going to keep open. But they're saying they expect the merger is going to result in $150 million in annual cost savings. And it's unlikely all that's going to be achieved through, you know, the synergies with the company supplying iron ore to itself.
Mm-hmm.
So this raises a lot of questions and concerns. ArcelorMittal obviously has been a big corporate sponsor throughout Northwest Indiana. They've done, you know, all if you've ever been to a Chamber of Commerce function anywhere, you know, they're usually like, you know, one of the named sponsors. They have, you know, they recently sponsored that trail, the Veterans Trail that's going in by Hebron. They fund STEM programming all across Northwest Indiana, provide STEM grants to teachers as they try to develop a pipeline of workers. They had the Steelworker for the Future program at Ivy Tech. This will have a major impact on, they've just done a significant amount of corporate philanthropy. They've worked with, like, the Field Museum on environmental initiatives. They've done a significant amount of community or supported a significant amount of community causes across Northwest Indiana. And then this new company is nowhere going to be near the size in, you know, capitalization or have nearly as many resources or deep pockets. It's at most going to be like a fifth of the size that ArcelorMittal was. And then,
I was kind
of a stunning development.
I was going to ask you, and you may have had at least, or you're reaching out to find out more. Has there been one among these unanswered questions? One of them that comes up locally is what kind of impact this is going to have on the United Steelworkers Union here in Northwest Indiana. Any idea? I'm sure they're looking into this very carefully. They probably already know, certainly on a national level, we're talking about the union people, on a national level about Cleveland Cliffs. They may be actually dealing with them at their facilities over in Ohio, but there are probably a lot of questions that they have yet to ask about this company and the change in ownership.
Yes, they'll have to. They have one thing too that Cleveland Cliffs has worked with the United Steelworkers Union for years.
Mm-hmm.
They are used to it, so there's not going to be any kind of cultural shock or anything there. That's, you know, they've said, you know, they've had strong relationships with the part of their rationale for the deal is they have strong relationships with the United Steelworkers, the United Auto Workers, and the Machinist Union. The current contract will likely carry over. I do need to check on the details of that.
Right.
But then they'll have to go in and negotiate a new contract in another year or so. And it'll be a new partner at the negotiating table. It was never super contentious between ArcelorMittal and the union, but you did have, the negotiations often stretched out. You did have a lot of rallies. I'm going to start getting feedback from a lot of the union local presidents on what they make of this and what they're expecting. But this is, at least this is a company that has experience working with, unions and not just the USW. And then part of the company said, you know, they're going to have improved operational capacities. They're going to be able to improve cost performance. They're going to have the full integration of steelmaking with raw material. But they're saying, you know, this is a company now that's going to be focused on the United States and the U.S. market. ArcelorMittal, obviously, it operated in like 60 countries worldwide. They're, you know, in Europe, they're in, you know, Asia, they're all over. And they are just getting out of the U.S.
Yeah.
now
entirely. Well, as you said earlier, that there are a lot of unanswered questions, and I'm sure everybody will want to know more, and we'll get the information. It's just going to take some time. This change isn't going to really take effect until the end of the calendar year, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. The deal closes then. It's probably subject to regulatory approval, and then the customary board. The board thing is usually a formality. The federal thing is typically a formality too, but I'm sure there'll be some scrutiny on this one because it's obviously going to affect steel workers across the country.
Yeah.
I think it's something like 19 facilities total because ArcelorMittal has a footprint across the Midwest and in Texas and just all over. They did have 18,000 employees in the U.S., and most of them were in northern Indiana or just across the border in the south suburbs. So this is kind of the core of their operations here in northwest Indiana. But the deal is slated to close at the end of the year.
Well, Joe, one of the other stories that we wanted to find out more about that you had in the Times in print and online lately is an interesting way to deal with the food desert problem in the city of Gary, and is a very innovative way for a couple of brothers to get back involved in the community that they're natives. Tell us more about Scott and Paul Yanover and their food truck and why it's set up where it is.
Yes, it launches later this month, I think. But Scott Yanover and Paul Yanover, they're a lawyer. Scott Yanover is a lawyer, and Paul Yanover is a doctor. They were born in Gary. They grew up partly in Miller, went on to Munster and then Indy, but they got roots in Gary. And they got to do the tour of the Gary Works steel mill last year, and they were kind of startled at the commissary had closed at the steel mill, and they were wondering where you could go to eat, because you have a couple fast food restaurants down in kind of the Midtown area, and a couple down the highway, the McDonald's and the Rally kind of down the street on US 12 and 20, but there's like very sparse dining options nearby,
right?
And so they kind of had the idea of opening a food truck park on Fifth Avenue. It's kind of going to be east of the U.S. Steel Yard on a vacant lot that the city owns. There had been an art park there previously. They are bringing in the former Majestic Star Casino chef, Tim Bellamy, and who's got worked in the city for a while, and restaurateur Daniel Krause, who had introduced food trucks in the University of Illinois back in 2012. And he now does the Craft on Milwaukee restaurant in the Wicker Park neighborhood. And what they're going to do is they're going to start a food truck park. Part of the rationale is that it's going to be stationary food trucks, and it's they want to lower the cost. Instead of opening a restaurant, they figure the operating costs will be lower. You got less overhead, less electricity bills, fewer staff. When you're not operating a building, it's just cheaper to do a food truck, and then hopefully make it more viable in the long run. And then also the other thing is opening in downtown Gary in the era of COVID. The idea is, for the food truck, they're going to have some picnic tables and that kind of thing, but a largely grab and go business. And, people aren't eating inside. Often a lot of people aren't eating inside still and during the pandemic. And it's the idea is, that it's kind of coronavirus safe because you're just grabbing and getting something to go, or you're distanced and you're not inside and where, scientists and doctors have said, the virus is prone to most likely to spread. And so they're going to open initially a spinoff of the Cracked on Milwaukee restaurant called Cracked, where it's going to specialize in kind of a lot of like higher end kind of breakfast stuff, like breakfast tacos, breakfast burritos. They're going to have like Parmesan truffle tots and some kind of fancier breakfast fare, but stuff you can just kind of grab on the way to the mill in the morning as you're pulling into work or whatever. And then they're also going to be opening initially another food truck. It's going to start with two food trucks, Blacktop BBQ, which would be like a Southern influenced barbecue menu with some kind of soul food sides, brisket and pulled pork and jerk chicken and things of that nature. And then they are looking at opening up to three more food trucks at the site.
Wow.
One would be like a stone-fired pizza. Yeah, they're basically making it like an outdoor food court is basically the idea they're going with. Like they're looking at doing a wood-fired pizza truck, a taco truck, and potentially a hot dog truck. But they say part of the benefit to their approach is that with food trucks, they can just basically see what works. And then if, you know, something's selling and something's not selling, they can just try different concepts if people aren't. Because it's kind of they're kind of looking to serve two areas. They're looking to serve the workers at the mill. It's on the way. It's going to be right near the main entrance to Gary Works. And then they're also looking at serving, you know, they're saying that the food service is downtown. There are a couple, you know, there are a couple restaurants. There's that restaurant at the ballpark. There's Triple T's. There's a hamburger restaurant on on Fifth Avenue, too, near there. But there's, you know, there's not a lot of dining options downtown.
That's right.
So, you know, I've been to the Gary Preservation Tour, and people were asking after the people had come in from Chicago, and they're asking, like, what are they can eat? And the docents were telling them, well, you'll probably have to drive out to Miller because there's not a lot of dining options in the area.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're looking to remedy that, and they're looking for, you know, good quality food options for, you know, local residents who live in the area. They're emphasizing their food is quality. It's going to be cooked on a kitchen off-site and cooked fresh. They're doing it in partnership with Art House, the social kitchen, which was originally created by the city and Bloomberg Philanthropies with the intention of addressing the, you know, the food desert in the city. Because at the time when it was started, you had a city of around 80,000 people and only 60 restaurants. And then this is kind of part of, like, its charge to kind of help foster more of a system of culinary entrepreneurship in the city. And they said, you know, we might be seen as visionary or very crazy, but we think that, you know, people are going to want to be able to grab some quick food during the pandemic and, you know, either eat outside or take it to wherever it is they're going.
Well, Joe, let me ask this. We have to kind of close out the conversation today, but let me just ask one quick question. When is the food supposed to arrive? That is when the food trucks, the first two at least, that they're planning of the many that are going to show up in this spot, when are they supposed to be open for business?
Yes, they're initially going where they're going to go. They're going to do a tour of the city. They're doing that right now where they're going to like the BMV and the City Hall, and they're parking outside of places across Gary to kind of try to introduce people to their food and familiarize them with it. And then it's October 7th. I don't know what kind of what date that is or which day of the week that is, but it's October 7th is when they're hoping to open at their permanent location at there on Fifth Avenue.
Well, you know for sure that there'll be a lot of very hungry people waiting in line for the trucks to show up on the 7th. And Joseph P., thank you very much for spending your time, certainly doing all the research, talking with people for the stories that you had in print online for the Times today, and bringing us up to date on a good way to help deal with the food issue in downtown Gary, to be sure. Thanks. Talk to you again soon.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you. The 2020 campaign for Indiana governor, like so much of people's lives, has been overtaken by concerns about the ongoing pandemic and about the nationwide protests for racial injustice and police violence. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith talked with incumbent Republican Governor Eric Holcomb about the race's big issues.
I want to start with the thing that's dominated all of our lives for the last 6 months, which I'm sure you can guess is COVID-19.
Yes.
Looking back over the last 6 months then, is there any changes you would make? What would you change about the state's response to the pandemic?
Well, I certainly wouldn't change how proud I am of the way that three different sectors all came together in a real quickness and focus. And that is the nonprofit sector, the private sector, and the government sectors. And I'm not just talking about the state government, I'm talking about local governments as well. And so we're in a place where we can continue to manage our way through this. You know, we didn't ever shut down completely. A lot of people say you shut down. Well, I mean, there was a lot of business going on. And so when you balance the lives, first and foremost, and the livelihoods, we're proving you can go back to school. We're proving you can go back to work.
There's been criticism of the way you've spent the CARES Act money. Why are we sitting on so much of that money?
Well, we're being fiscally prudent about when we actually, not just as you point out, allocate, but actually spend. We're going to spend this the allocation that we've been given through the CARES dollars from our federal partners. We won't leave money sitting on the table. But look, I took equal criticism for not spending down the rainy day fund and not spending down our reserves. Thank goodness that we had those reserves to be able to bridge our way to the other side. And we're looking at where are the needs right now.
On to the other thing that's dominated headlines the last few months, which is racial inequity protests around police shootings of black men and women and things like that. Mm-hmm. You announced a series of steps that you want to see the state government take, but do Hoosiers of color in particular have reason to be skeptical that things will change?
Well, maybe to date, but hopefully not going forward because of the actions that we're taking and going to continue to take. After Mr. Floyd's death, it was crystallized in my mind that we have to do something different than just have those programs out there. And if there are barriers in my house, in the state government, then we need to make sure that we're removing those barriers and getting rid of those hurdles. And what it comes down to in my mind is empowerment. How are we going to empower people to better determine their own destinies?
I want to talk about education. Always an important issue for a gubernatorial campaign, but more important perhaps than ever because we will no longer have an elected state superintendent. Yep. So the first ever appointment for a state superintendent. What are the qualifications? What are you looking for in that person?
They're fluent in the area of education from, you know, the whole complete pathway of a student's life. So they have that experience. The same thing I'm looking for in every agency head, quite frankly. Someone who's honest, someone who's humble, and someone who's hungry.
Teacher pay. The vast majority of teachers in Indiana got a raise from the last state budget, we know. But it still doesn't get us to where we'd like to be because we started from behind.
That's right.
You have the Teacher Compensation Commission that was working on developing long-term solutions. Is that sort of the long-term solution for really paying our teachers what they deserve, mm-hmm. kind of off the table in the short term because of the pandemic and the economic struggles that have come with it?
No. I want it to be higher, as you point out. I've been very vocal about that. That's where this long-term, how do we sustain paying our teachers what they are worth and what we expect of them? And that's where they're looking at. And yes, COVID affected that. But it's not going to derail anything.
Thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you, Brandon.
Brandon also spoke with Holcomb's challenger, Democrat Dr. Woody Myers, about the same issues.
So let's talk about those issues that have dominated the headlines so much this year, the first, of course, being COVID-19. What would you have done differently?
Oh, so much. I wouldn't have followed Mike Pence's lead, for one thing, or Donald Trump's lead. And now we know that both of them have lied to the country repeatedly. There's the tapes to prove it. I know that we should have done our testing program far earlier, far more aggressively. A number of governors were very aggressive in bringing PPE supplies together for the folks in their states, and they were far more successful than we were. Now we see that in our nursing homes, for instance, the cost of a dollar's worth of PPE 6 months ago was $6 to $10 now, and that has been because we did not aggregate our purchasing power. We did not have an inventory in place. That's something I would absolutely have done. We moved the stages along too quickly. In addition to that, we don't even today have a mask mandate in Indiana. We have a mask suggestion. And it's just my view that what was absent from the beginning was true leadership.
So the governor has been criticized, particularly recently, for how much money from the federal CARES Act, the COVID relief dollars, are still unspent in Indiana.
Right.
Is it prudent for the governor to at least wait on some of this money to see what more comes out of the federal government?
And how many people will die during that wait? And how many more people will get infected during that wait? The answer is no. You use the funds that you have now, and if the federal government is guilty of not providing complete and adequate instruction, so you ask later for forgiveness.
I want to talk about the other issue that has dominated our conversation the last, our national conversation, our state conversation the last several months, which is racial injustice. We've seen some steps that Governor Holcomb announced in recent weeks, the hiring of a cabin officer, reviewing all of the training that goes on at the police academy here in Indiana. Is it a good first step?
If that's truly in his heart, if that's truly what he believes, then he could have done it 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. when he first took office, or he could have encouraged his previous boss, Mike Pence, to do it. You know, Brandon, we've got now almost 16 years of leadership in the State House by a Republican governor, and here it is 60, 70 days before an election, that this is now an important issue. I'm not going to need a special officer to look over the work of everybody else and then report on how everybody else is doing. I'm going to hire people from the beginning who know how important diversity is, who know how important inclusion is.
Let's talk about education. Always an important issue, of course, in an Indiana governor's race. It's more than half of the state budget. But perhaps more important than it's ever been because there is no longer an elected state superintendent of public instruction. This will, you would be the first governor, if elected, to appoint that role. What are you looking for in that person? What kind of qualifications are you looking for?
Somebody who's a true leader, somebody who knows how to communicate with the public, communicate with teachers, someone who the teachers trust, someone who has an intimate knowledge of how school systems work today and how they could work better, but someone also who's willing to question how we are doing our work today and whether or not there are better ways to do it in the future.
Indiana's been looking at studying teacher pay here for a few years now. We know that we are doing poorly as it relates to our neighboring states and states across the country.
Right.
Because of the budget challenges that Indiana, like so many other states, will be facing for the next few years, are teachers just going to have to wait a little longer for those long-term solutions?
Not for me, they're not. We're going to find the money to pay the teachers of the state of Indiana what they deserve. They are the future of our state. We will go through that state budget with a fine-tooth comb. We will make every change required in order to make sure that our teachers get what they deserve.
Dr. Myers, thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Thank you for asking.
And Brandon Smith also spoke with Libertarian Party challenger Donald Rainwater about the race's big issues.
As a Libertarian, what do you see as the role of government in addressing the pandemic?
Provide the citizens with the information necessary to decide for ourselves how best to safeguard our lives and the lives of our families. I believe that all too often, the idea that government can protect everyone is misguided.
What about the government? Governor Holcomb's response hasn't worked in your mind? The number of cases, as it relates to the number of tests, has come down in recent months. You know, he touts those numbers, says it's clear the response is working. What about it didn't work for you?
Many, almost a million Hoosiers have had to file unemployment claims since the first week of March. We have no idea what the economic ripple impact of the executive orders will be from now over the next couple of years.
The money that's come from the federal government, primarily by way of the CARES Act, intended for COVID relief. Indiana's still sitting on $1.3 billion of that $2.4 billion we've gotten.
And many of the folks who are still unemployed haven't got unemployment checks,
right,
because our unemployment insurance system is antiquated. We're not helping those who were displaced economically by the governor's unilateral executive orders.
If you're governor of Indiana, as you see the problem of racial injustice, not in just in government, but in society in general, what then is the role for government to help address that crisis?
Much of the, what we'll call racial injustice, has been government overreach. Here again, whether it was to oppress someone or to attempt to make up for past bad acts, it doesn't work. You can't use government to fix something that really can't be fixed.
What role do you see for police reform?
We need to have an honest, straightforward discussion about holding individuals accountable for individuals' actions. And I don't think we do that today. I think we all too often want to blame a group of people for one person's bad actions. I'm a proponent for body cams. I think it protects both the officer and the citizen. I believe that we need to do better training.
So education is always a big deal in an Indiana governor's race. The governor will now appoint the state superintendent of public instruction for the first time,
as
well, instead of that position being elected. If you're hiring that state superintendent, what qualifications are you looking for?
Well, I'm looking for someone, first of all, who has not only been involved in public education, but someone who also has experience and knowledge and open-mindedness toward educational choice in Indiana. I believe we unfortunately politicize education entirely too much in the state of Indiana. And we need to focus on making sure that the dollars that Hoosier taxpayers pay for education get to the kids in the classrooms.
Mr. Rainwater, thanks so much for sitting down with me.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
And now you've heard from all three candidates for Indiana governor in the November 3rd election. That's it for Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks to Andrew Steele and to Joseph Pete of The Times and to Brandon Smith with Indiana Public Broadcasting for the conversations today.